or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, our theme was Off the Hill, the influence of U.S. politics in Canada. In this panel, our guests dissected the explosive world of U.S. politics and discussed the many ways our neighbors south of the border influence Canada. Our panel included NDP MP Charlie Angus, senior researcher at the CCPA Stuart True, and Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
Well, there are many stark distinctions between Canada and the U.S., including the horrifying number of guns and weapons in the U.S., which far outweigh the number of people. Another key difference is that Canada has a tighter, more transparent voting system. But both countries also share similarities that are often obscured by the narrative that frames Canada as fundamentally kinder and gentler than the U.S. However, both countries share histories of slavery and Indigenous genocide that manifest today as systemic anti-Black and anti-Indigenous discrimination. Whether we're talking differences or similarities, there's no denying, though, that what happens south of the 49th parallel deeply impacts Canada from politics to the economy to culture and global reputation. So to begin our conversation today, let's start with you, Charlie. As an MP, you have doggedly called out and exposed the rise of U.S.-style right-wing politics in Canada, whether it's through the promotion of conspiracy theories, fake news, dog whistle politics, or voter manipulation. You said it's picking up the pace here in Canada. Tell us what you've been observing in the political arena and what we need to be aware of.
It's a really important question because we are going into deeply uncharted territory. And I will say, you know, I was in the opposition benches for the entire Stephen Harper era. I saw these guys up close. What I'm seeing with the Pierre Poilievre crew is a different bunch, very different, and that's concerning. I'll frame it that in 2018, I was part of a parliamentary committee looking into political interference from disinformation that was the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And it was the first time and the only time in my entire political career where Liberals, Conservatives, New Democrats all worked together because we saw this threat as hugely potentially damaging. We worked internationally. We launched this international parliamentary investigation into Facebook and manipulation of democratic processes. But I don't think what we understood was that as we were thinking of this as an exterior threat, our own brains and our own society was being rapidly rewired. And that's the thing we're dealing with now. What is driving conspiracy? Is it this outside threat from the United States, or is it politicians picking up on what's happening within our own society in Canada? I think we have to really look at how alienation conspiracy is being driven actually from the grassroots and then being reflected and verified and augmented by the front bench of the Pierre Poilievre caucus. The difference between Poilievre and Harper in a nutshell is that Harper kept the real crazies on the back bench. Poilievre seems to have decided that putting them on the front bench is really the ticket to success in the next election. And whether or not it speaks volumes about how much Canada and the United States, I think, are in very, very treacherous waters right now.
Thanks a lot, Charlie. Stuart, let's go to you. In your role at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, you pay close attention to massive economic influences and domination from the U.S. What are the key economic issues this election year, and how could they affect Canadians?
Thanks, Robin. It's a pretty big question. I mean, there's a lot of economic issues, I would say, that definitely affect Canada, you know, mainly because of how integrated we are, right? How integrated the Canadian economy is with the U.S. economy. I'm going to focus on two of them, and I would encourage you, Robin, to just cut me off if you think I'm going too long. Because I focus on trade policy at the CCPA, I'm going to look at that first, and then I'd like to consider some of these nascent decarbonization efforts of the Biden administration. I think those are two areas where one where it may be less concern and one where there's quite a bit of concern from my perspective. trade obviously always is high on the political agenda in the United States. I mean, people here in Canada, where polls consistently show, you know, 80% support for new trade agreements, may be surprised or maybe not that, you know, most Americans or a large portion of them are very skeptical of the free trade agenda still. People might have recalled that even Obama, right, back in the day, as part of his campaign in 2008, had to promise that he would renegotiate NAFTA if he was elected. Something, of course, he didn't do, and he kind of went right into these major NAFTA plus negotiations with the Trans-Pacific Partnership in Europe, for example. Anyway, we all kind of know since then, kind of coming back to closer to the present, that, you know, Trump gets this reputation as the big disruptor of that agenda. And I think to a large extent, he deserves that. You know, we know the tariffs he threw up on, you know, almost all Chinese imports, very high tariffs. We got hit by tariffs in Canada too on steel and aluminum. You know, essentially he kind of disrupted this trade agenda. But I think the point I'd like to make is that where trade, we hear in Canada a lot from certain establishment voices that, you know, we should be really worried about a Trump win because of the potential to disrupt Canadian trade. I think we should have to realize that this agenda is kind of, you know, bipartisan now in the United States. There's been a real shift in both parties. Many aspects of the trade policy they're in complete agreement on, you know, whether it's, you know, that trade should be worker-centered, for example. And of course, there's differences in what that might mean between the parties. There's an agreement, for better or worse, that, you know, China is a strategic enemy of the United States, and that they should be taking whatever means they can to decouple from China and encourage more of what's being produced there to be produced in the United States. You know, I don't think we have to fully endorse these policies or agree with them entirely to kind of admit that they're a little bit interesting. And I think in some cases, especially the worker-centered trade innovations of the Biden administration, I think in some cases they're kind of refreshing, right? After years of being told that there is no other way other than these neoliberal standard free trade deals. You know, I think just thinking, you know, the tariffs is important in the sense that would we get hit by this broad wall of tariffs Trump is promising to put on all countries or a large number of countries is if elected. I think it's, you know, interesting to consider. I suspect it's probably not going to be the case. You know, we have to consider that Trump actually negotiated the new NAFTA that we have now, the USMCA, and is unlikely to do something that would violate that. At least I think he is. A much bigger economic question mark for me, Robin, is with huge implications for our economy, is this fate of the green transition or whatever you want to call it. You know, like, we can debate how effective Biden's measures have been, right? If we look at things like the Inflation Reduction Act, the subsidies for electric vehicle manufacturing, you know, it's definitely not the green New Deal the progressives wanted in the United States. It's not the Build Back Better package that would have substantially expanded American public services, healthcare, and social safety net and green infrastructure. Nonetheless, it is an honest attempt to decarbonize, lower emissions, and bring back some innovative manufacturing to the United States, right? I think Trump, like Poilievre here in Canada, is blaming that kind of government action, which has, I think, a lot of beneficial potential, is blaming it for the inflationary shock, right? As we've seen here in Canada over the past few years, totally unsubstantiated. And in order to get elected, you know, on the backs of legitimate concerns about cost of living, and then to just go back to a very standard pro-corporate Republican conservative playbook, which is going to be deregulation, government cutbacks, making earlier Trump tax cuts permanent, and drilling, right? Drilling for more oil and gas, right? Or kind of falling back on fossil fuels. So I think that's what I'm worried about. And I'm worried about in the sense that it has the potential to undercut or like swipe the knees out of Canada's own moves in that direction, right? Its own transition in terms of EV supply chains. You know, we supply the American market, right, for automobiles. And if there's any disruptions to that transition as it goes, it's going to have implications for jobs here. The flip side is also the case, right? So it's complicated because what is Trump going to do? Is he going to say, well, these measures, these subsidies are actually successfully kind of undermining the competitiveness of Chinese electric vehicle manufacturing, and we're going to go along with them, right? Or is he going to actively work against that in order to benefit like big oil and get us back onto gas guzzlers and that kind of thing? The other question is, if he does support it, is he going to go, you know, even further and say, well, you know, we don't agree that you should be including Canada and Mexico as allied nations for the purpose of benefiting from the subsidies. We want all of the manufacturing to take place in the United States. So we're actually going to start pointing fingers and saying, you know, like we want your whatever it is, Northvolt or other investments, Honda, for example, investing in Canadian Gigafactory. We expect some of that money to come into the United States. So anyway, either way, there's questions that I think the government needs to be asking, preparing for, and preparing in close consultation, I would think, with private sector unions. But I'll leave it there for now, and maybe there's some questions later.
Excellent. No, thank you, Stuart. No, I let you go a little longer there because it's good to get the breakdown on the economic stuff. So, Nick, let's bring you in. As Rabble's editor, you've kept a close eye on American politics. You recently wrote a Rabble article on conservative MP Lesley Lewis's U.S.-influenced anti-UN United Nations petition. So as a journalist, what changes are you seeing in Canada with the rise of right-wing politics and the links to U.S. politics?
Yeah, well, this follows on very well to Charlie's earlier comments of seeing, you know, more extreme politicians move from the back conservative benches further to the front. Lesley Lewis isn't a backbench conservative MP. She's Pierre Poilievre's shadow minister for infrastructure. This petition that she's circulating and she's putting forth in parliament is a good recent example of the growth of unfounded conspiracy theories in Canada that are directly influenced from the U.S. The man who co-wrote this petition that Lewis presented is putting forth these theories about how the UN is part of a secret plan to commit genocide in the year 2030 and change human DNA and all sorts of crazy stuff. His group, Prevent Genocide 2030, was co-founded with an American doctor who was throwing around alternative COVID cures during the pandemic. So you're seeing really direct connections between the far right extreme in the United States and it entering into Canada. And this isn't the first time in our recent history. We saw it during the Freedom Convoy as well. There was a heavy American influence on the Freedom Convoy. I was working for my local paper here in Cornwall, Ontario at the time. We received the leaked list of donors who gave to the convoy through the right-wing Give, Send, Go app, and we saw a lot of local Canadian names here in this part of Eastern Ontario, but the biggest donors were in the States. So you have, again, there another direct connection of far-right interests in the United States entering into Canada, trying to influence our politics here in Canada. We also have examples of this coming up in the near future, just this month. Tucker Carlson will be on stage in Edmonton, Alberta, alongside Jordan Peterson and Conrad Black. Tucker Carlson, well known for shopping when he was still at a job at Fox News in far right conspiracy theories, in white supremacist rhetoric, in COVID conspiracy theories, all sorts of really awful far right stuff that he's bringing to Alberta. I was a little bit gratified to know that they're having a very hard time selling tickets to that show. I understand that they're $800 a pop, and a donor has recently purchased around 3,000 of them that they're giving away for free. So, you know, maybe the level of interest in Canada for what Tucker Carlson is selling is not quite there. But again, just another example of U.S. far-right politics trying to find a home and trying to find a root in Canada. And, you know, in the U.S., I think how you saw the rise of Donald Trump and Tucker Carlson and other far right wing figures in the mainstream was it's happened over the course of decades. It started in the 1980s with the deregulation of, fair and balanced news coverage. It's also been tied to the cutbacks in public education in the United States, done mostly by conservative governors in right-wing states. And Canada isn't quite there yet in terms of that kind of far-right media landscape. We don't really have anything in Canada that you could really say is like a Fox News or even like a Newsmax, even as much as Ezra Levant and his outfit would like to claim to be. But that isn't to say that we're not free from danger. We're not free from getting there. I think you're seeing, more far right wing and extremist rhetoric in a lot of post media newspapers. Also, we are seeing, much like in the States, a weakening of public institutions, and especially a weakening of legitimate, independent news media. You know, news media that reports without bias, with integrity. Support rabble.ca, by the way, rabble.ca/donate. just this week, or maybe it was late last, a poll done by Heritage Canada was covered, I believe, in the Globe and Mail, that showed that Canadians responding to this poll had weakening faith in all public institutions, whether it was municipal, provincial, or federal government, and it also included news media. This is a worrying trend. We could see ourselves sliding further into a place where, like in the States, it's post-truth, it's media silos, where people are only getting their news from one specific source, and they can be, if you're only getting your news from one specific source, you know, and that source is manipulating you, you know, it leads to what you see in the United States.
No, thanks, Nick. Yeah. So a question to all of you now. We've kind of focused a lot on the negatives, right? The negative thing that from America that influenced Canada, but are there positives also? So I want to get each of your thoughts on that. So why don't let me reverse the order and go Nick and then Stuart and then Charlie.
You're keeping me on my toes tonight, Robin. Positives, yeah, of course. You know, much like there is, you know, cross pollination on the far right, I think there is also opportunities for cross pollination on the left. And I don't think it was coincidental that in 2023 you saw a great year for unions in Canada and in the United States. I think that the labor movement, in particular, cross the border, is very, very strong right now. I think maybe it is even feeding off of each other. I hope that, and you know, we're seeing unions really at the forefront of the fight against a lot of this far right wing rhetoric. And we saw it in the late summer and early fall of 2023 with the so-called 1 million March for Children, which was another far right wing movement shopping conspiracies and anti-transphobic, anti-2S LGBTQIA plus rhetoric. And to me, the people who I saw out there the most pushing back against this form of hate were unionized workers. It was QP Ontario. It was the Ontario Federation of Labor. It was the ETFO. It was the OSSTF. It was these teachers unions and all sorts from across the length and breadth of labor came out onto Parliament Hill and to communities across this country to stand up against far right rhetoric. And I think that they were able to do that because of the strength of the labor movement right now. We saw major gains, especially in the auto industry, for unionized workers in 2023. We saw that both in Canada and the United States. And I think that is one example of a positive traffic going both ways across the border in terms of political support.
Thank you, Stuart.
Okay, Robin. When you sent this question, I thought about it. So it's kind of like asking if there's anything good about getting pneumonia. You know, like I mean, I'm sure there are benefits, but I couldn't think of them immediately. But then I guess thinking back to the presentation on economics and the economic impacts and that kind of thing. I don't know if people saw Prime Minister Trudeau claimed yesterday that, in relation to Trump's win in the Iowa primaries, that one of Canada's greatest strengths when dealing with Washington, whoever's there, is how integrated our two economies are. You know, he said it's something that governments have smartly worked on for decades. And I thought it was quite amazing and puzzling thing to say. You know, if we were less integrated, surely events in politics, right, in the U.S. would have less of an effect on us. But in any case, I think as a result of that economic integration, you know, when U.S. governments start doing things, good or bad, it has good or bad effects on us, right? So like canceling trans-border oil pipelines, you know, like Keystone XL, or making auto emissions or consumer product energy efficiency rules more stringent. That's kind of a boring example, but, you know, or demanding that the government deal with far-right protests, right? Blocking trade routes across the border. I mean, we didn't do, as far as I can tell, Canada didn't really seriously move to do anything about those protests until it was, you know, the governor of Michigan, right? And Washington to say we should be acting on that. It has, obviously, there's the opposite effect too. I mean, you know, in the Bush era, I'm thinking back to the deregulation around rail transportation, right? That directly led to the Lac-Mégantic explosion of July 2013, because what does Canada do? Well, we mimic the regulations. So there's some extreme negatives of that as well. But I think at the current moment, just to go back to what I was saying earlier, you know, if you have an administration seemingly committed to meeting climate objectives for the first time, I don't know, ever, you know, putting money into reshoring certain high value added good sectors, infrastructure that's been degraded, putting money into that, that's just necessarily automatically going to benefit Canadian exports, and that's going to have a positive effect on jobs. I'm not saying it's an unqualified benefit. Like, I'm thinking, like, where's the social license necessarily, for example, for expanding mining, you know, critical minerals exploration in order to feed that U.S. renewal, if that's in fact where we're going. So it's not an uncritical benefit, but just to say that there are benefits. And then last thing I'll say, because Nick was talking about cross-border civil society connections, that's absolutely critical and always a benefit for us. And, you know, we're currently working with U.S. and Mexican groups right now on a dispute that's been raised under the Canada-U.S.-Mexico agreement against Mexico's genetically engineered corn decrees from earlier in 2023. Very positive policy, very much responded to.
Small clip from our most recent panel, Off the Hill, The Influence of U.S. Politics in Canada. To watch the full video of our panel, please visit Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. To support events like this, you can become a monthly donor for rabble.ca or gift a one-time donation. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in world news, the International Court of Justice is now deliberating after the closing arguments between South Africa and Israel. South Africa brought a motion to the International Court of Justice to disrupt Israel's campaign against the Palestinians of Gaza and to impose provisional measures to prevent genocide. In its application, South Africa states that it believes that Israel's acts and omissions in relation to Palestinians violates the Genocide Convention. The core of South Africa's argument is based around the ongoing bombing campaign of Gaza, which has killed tens of thousands of civilians, many of whom are children, since October. As well, South Africa points to the blockade of Gaza as an example of the deprivation of the necessities of life. In its response, Israel claimed that South Africa's arguments were, quote, deliberately curated, decontextualized, and a manipulative description of the reality of the current hostilities, end quote, and disregarded Israel's right to defend itself. The International Court of Justice has not given a timeline for when they will release their decision. In national news, a federal poll conducted by Heritage Canada suggests that the public has low confidence in all levels of government, as well as in news and social media. Municipal government has the most public confidence at just 41%, followed by financial institutions at 35%. Media critic John Miller said that the lack of confidence in news media was particularly concerning, but not surprising. Miller points to the federal government's over $500 million investment in legacy media as actually contributing to the erosion of confidence in traditional news, and their controversial Bill C-18 as damaging outlets that depend on an online presence. Miller is calling for a royal commission to review the state of news with the goal of restoring financial viability and confidence in the industry. In environmental news, Dave Suzuki is warning that while profits for the fossil fuel industry continue to rise, so do global temperatures. Suzuki warns that 2024 will likely be the year where global average temperatures will rise by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, a milestone that the 2015 International Paris Climate Agreement hoped to stay below to avoid severe climate disasters. Suzuki argues that we must continue to loudly lobby our leaders to phase out all forms of fossil fuels from our economy. In Alberta politics, longtime Alberta NDP leader Rachel Notley confirmed what many had expected for some time, that she will step down as leader of her party. Notley had been leader of the Alberta NDP since 2014 and led her party to a majority government in 2015. She served as Premier of Alberta for 4 years until losing her re-election bid to Jason Kenney and his United Conservative Party. Notley was unsuccessful last year in defeating the United Conservative Premier Danielle Smith, who led the Conservatives to another majority government. Notley successfully led the Alberta NDP from a fringe party to a viable alternative to the United Conservatives. Notley will remain as leader until his successor is chosen. The Alberta NDP will begin the process of finding a new leader later this month. And finally, in a follow-up to last week's sad news of the death of former federal NDP leader Ed Broadbent, this week it was announced that he would be receiving a state funeral on January 28th. Broadbent is only the second person not to be Prime Minister and the second NDP leader to receive a state funeral after Jack Layton. Broadbent passed away on Thursday, January 11th. He was 87 years old. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
This is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.